Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we bring you a conversation with Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Pressley is a Black congresswoman, and we emphasize that because she was elected Massachusetts's first Black congresswoman after being Boston's first Black woman on the Boston City Council. She's making history now, and with that has come all kinds of public conversation about her identity. So today we're not talking student debt or police reform or housing costs, child care. Today we're talking about her and who she is. Pressley joined us in WBUR Studio 3 on Tuesday. And actually, I started by telling her about my own late mom and then asking her about hers. Sandra Pressley transitioned, as the congresswoman says, at the age of 63 in 2011 after a long battle with leukemia.
And I'm an only child. And she raised me alone. So it is, I don't think any child is prepared, even when you're an adult, to lose a parent. Certainly not a mother. They knew you 9 months before anyone else did. And they are the keeper of your memories. And I never lamented being an only child. I loved the independence. And I learned how to enjoy my own company. And was a voracious reader and an imaginative child. I had an imaginary friend and all of those things. But the first time I lamented being an only child was as a caregiver. Mm. And then after my mother's transition, because mothers are the keeper of your memories, I didn't have anyone else to say, remember that time that mommy said or mommy did. It had really just been the two of us. And I feel inordinately blessed. We don't get to choose our parents. I'm grateful that God, the universe, conspired that she would be my vessel and my first teacher. And, I draw from a reservoir of wisdom and hope and joy that she instilled in me, my faith in God, very foundational to how I live my life, you know. So there are many, many gifts that she gave me. Now, I will say the best advice I was given, and I never say dies, okay? Mm-hmm. Some of that is about my faith practice, which is why I say she transitioned, because mm-hmm. we believe she is going somewhere else. But also the reason I say she transitioned is because our former Suffolk County Sheriff, Andrea Cabral,
yeah.
like many others at the time who were close to me, did come to visit with my mother when she was on life support. And I was, sleeping in the reception area, in the church sanctuary, and, you know, closets, wherever I could, because I was her proxy and I couldn't, you know, be too far away. And she came to visit, and her mother had recently passed. And she said, never forget that, you know, life is energy. And so it never dies. It just transforms. It's just absorbed. And that helped me tremendously because I told myself that my mother physically was transitioning. And now I would absorb that energy. I would absorb and carry with me the best parts of her. And so whenever I do something that is characteristically Sagittarius, my mother was a Sagittarius. I mean, I grew up in a very, you know, faith-based, even, you know, at times religious household. But for some reason, we still love astrology and horoscopes. So anytime I do anything that's like characteristically Sagittarius, my mother would wear earrings that didn't match. She was a little eccentric, kind of artsy. And I would say, you know, mommy, why are you wearing that? And she would say, because I can. So anytime I do something a little eccentric, or I'm dancing like no one's watching, or I do something thoughtful, like send a thank you note, or I extend grace, or trip. She was very clumsy. I say, that's my mom showing up, you know. Yeah. So that's sort of how, but it is a permanent heartbreak.
Do you ever feel like you can dance anymore with no one watching?
Well, now I'm a member of Congress, so
right.
definitely not.
Right. Well, so that's the thing, right? Yeah. Because that really struck me. And I'm not even going to apologize for being all over the place.
Yeah.
In reading and preparing for today, one of the things that struck me was, you've been pretty clear about, but until one reads it all in one place, just how much you make people angry and how much they're paying attention and how much they're talking at you and about you all the time. And I wonder if you're going to put out the kind of energy that you plus mom, right, puts out, what does it cost you to do that? And there's never a moment where you can dance and no one's watching.
Okay, well, let me say this, sticking with my mom, okay, the most formidable influence in my life. I'm very fortunate in that because it was just my mother and I sort of versus the world. I mean, I have to say my father is very present in my life now, very proud of him. He's done incredible things as an author, a college professor, battled substance use disorder for a number of years, and so was not in my life during my formative years. So it was just my mother and I. And I'm very fortunate because we were each other's best friend. From a very young child, I saw her as a woman, not just my mother. I saw her humanity.
That's interesting.
Okay. Yeah. And so I saw my mother train and mentor men, mostly white men, who were then promoted over her and paid more. I saw my mother, this woman, endure the pain of uterine fibroids, have a radical hysterectomy, and then have to return to work mere days after that, to the point that she collapsed on the street and had to be taken away by an ambulance because there wasn't sympathy or sensitivities to the health challenges that women specifically have, and there was no paid leave, and she had to get back to work. I saw my mother push through as a survivor of domestic violence. I saw my mother unable when I was a very young child to pay for childcare. And so I had to be a latchkey kid in a home alone and was given very strict instructions to not let people know I was alone because she was fearful that they would take me away from her. And so I say all that to say that I received an education, a tutelage early on that to be black and to be a woman is the dichotomy of being hyper-visible and invisible at the same time. Okay? And so I've been black and female my whole life. And so because I had a great teacher in my mother, even when those lessons were sometimes heartbreaking, that has informed the space that I take up, how I navigate and how I move. So, yes, I know that I can strike a polarizing chord at times, but I would say I'm only honoring my mother, who was a truth teller, who was civically engaged, who was a community and movement builder. So this is sort of how I'm hardwired, if you will. And I think I gain more than it has cost me, because whenever I take up that space to dance as if no one is watching, to speak truth without trying to appease or pacify, I know that I'm honoring my mother, and I'm also creating space for other people. And as I said in my alopecia reveal, I do believe that I'm not here just to occupy space. I'm here to create it. And that's what I do as a legislator. That is what I do as a movement builder. That is what I do as a black woman, as a black progressive woman. That is what I seek to do in all things. Even how I show up in the world is to not just take up space, but to create it for others.
You know, I remember sitting up in the balcony, and okay, age sometimes makes you think you know what building you were in, but I'll just say I think it was Faneuil Hall.
Okay.
It is possible it wasn't. And watching you be sworn in to the Boston City Council. It's January 4th, it's 2010. I'm sitting up in the rafters. At that point, it was 3 years for me as president of Catholic Charities, the first woman to hold that role. And just in the smaller space I was occupying, feeling what it meant to be the first woman in a role. And to sit up in that balcony and watch you. And by the way, so interesting because you wore a white jacket.
You are taking it all the way back.
I am.
Yes. I was in a, I really appreciated that fit, I have to say.
It was gorgeous.
It was in a, I was in a winter white fitted jacket and probably a black dress because black is my power color. Nice little roller set. But I was the, at that time, you know, when you think about that stage, right, 2010, first woman of color, first black woman elected to the Boston City Council. I'm elected citywide. And, you know, it took 100 years to break that concrete ceiling a former UMass Boston professor, Carol Hardy Fanta, she coined the term that in her research that when women of color break ceilings, they're not glass, they're concrete. So it took 100 years to break that concrete ceiling. And my motivation to run had never been to make history. I just wanted to make a difference.
But you knew when you were going to make history.
But I was aware of it, but it wasn't the motivating factor. I didn't discount it. And actually, let me tell the whole truth. There were times I tried to discount it. I felt very uncomfortable because people wanted to give me a lot of awards for winning. Mm. And I would, you know, caution them and say, well, let me actually accomplish something first. And then finally, an elder in the community said, stop denying us. Mm. Don't deny us. Don't rob us of this victory. You are a first. And I was so focused on the responsibility, at times even the unique burden, that I was missing the blessing. I was missing the beauty. I was missing the gift. I was missing the victory. As women, you know, we're so uncomfortable for us to boss up, you know, and own a victory. So I was just very focused on, you know, demonstrating humility and focus, because a lot of people at that time were saying that my victory was about identity politics. So there were some who said my victory was proof in a Obama era, quote unquote, post-racial. I never bought into that. That's what my victory was indicative of, that people had elected a black woman to represent the whole city. So that was an indicator. There was a paradigm shift occurring. We were now in a post-racial Boston.
Well, and I feel the obligation to tell our listeners, Felix Arroyo was also elected in that
Correct.
Round, right?
Correct.
And breaking ground, too.
And so and they had that same narrative, you know, for him as well. So people were either saying my identity was irrelevant, okay, or they were saying that was why people voted for me. And I was, again, carrying the dichotomy of these narratives. And I said, I just need to focus on accomplishing something tangible, real. And in my focus on that, I was denying myself the significance of this and what it meant to occupy this space. And when you see that visual, and for me, when I was seated on that stage,
it was, I can't.
And for people don't understand, it's a 13-member body.
It was such a visual.
13-member body. And also, Maureen Feeney was leaving, right? And so for, I think, two of my terms, I was the only woman. But it was in that moment on that stage, I gave myself permission, you know, let it go. Really take this in. And I thought about all the sacrifices my mother made. I have to say, may she rest in peace and power, because my mother transitioned when I was running for re-election for the first time, and everyone thought I was going to be one and done, didn't even think I was going to get re-elected. And that was the first time I actually topped the ticket, was shortly after she transitioned. But my mother is the only person not surprised by any of this with my life. I was born premature, 7 months, and it was her theory that it was because I was eager and ready to get to work. Secondly, I was born in the month of February, Black History Month, because I was destined to make black history.
Happy birthday, by the way. It was last week.
February 3rd. Yes, yes. And so I, you know, had this, I was very blessed to be rooted in the soil of someone who believed in my greatness. And, you know, for that, I will always be grateful.
So let's follow that thread for a minute, because I don't often choose to talk about what women wear, and that's not actually the point about what I'm about to say, but it's a symbol, mm-hmm. right? Because you did wear that white,
yes.
that winter white. When I went back and looked at the pictures and I looked at the images, right, it struck me so much. Now we fast forward to the women in Congress, the big wave in 2018, and all the women wearing white. Have you come to a point now where it is, in fact, consciously now part of crashing through concrete ceilings, making space, recognizing that when you do things and it's the first, it's like stretching a muscle, it never quite goes back to the way it was before. I can't imagine you now, and maybe I'm projecting, saying, well, it wasn't about making history at all, because it is making history.
It is making history, but again, that wasn't the motivation. I knew if I was successful in my 2018 bid for Congress, running against, you know, an incredible incumbent, you know, who would serve the district well.
For our listeners, Mike Capuano.
Mike Capuano. I knew that if I were successful in that endeavor, I would be the first person of color in the Massachusetts congressional delegation in its 230-year history. So there was an awareness, but that wasn't the motivation. And again, one of the things I struggle with, Tiziana, is that I find that as we see more women, so look, the Boston City Council has completely changed. City councils throughout the Massachusetts 7th, I want to say that, have changed. I have Michelle Wu as the mayor of Boston, Sumbul Siddiqui as the mayor of Cambridge, Katiana Ballantyne is the mayor of Somerville.
Kim Driscoll, first woman mayor of Salem, is now
the lieutenant governor.
Right.
You know, Maura Healey
is our
governor. And the
first women top ticket.
The Boston City Council is now majority people of color, majority women. Congress has made great strides in leadership parity, in having a government that is more representative of the citizenry that we serve. But I will say, what does bother me is that pundits will credit this to anomalies and flukes or a wave. And when you do that, you deny us the agency and the ownership of strategy, messaging, intellect, sweat equity, labor. I mean, just to give people context, I know there's a narrative sort of for people outside of Massachusetts, like I just fell out of the sky and suddenly was in Congress. I worked on my first campaign to elect the first black mayor in the city of Chicago, Harold Washington, a huge influence in my life when I was 10 years old. I worked for Congressman Joseph P. Kennedy II as an unpaid intern, working three paid jobs when this was the 8th congressional seat.
You were a college student at the time.
Yes. 25 plus years later, I'm now the congresswoman of the seat. When I came here in 1992 from Chicago, didn't know a soul, found community, refined my purpose, built myself up so that I could build my community up, received an incredible political tutelage in the office of Congressman Joseph P. Kennedy II, working in his Roxbury satellite office, then went on to work for United States Senator John Kerry for 11 years, both in Washington and in district, then served on the Boston City Council for 8 years, three times, humbly, I say this, earned the trust and confidence of the electorate to be the top vote getter in three consecutive elections, and then ran for Congress. And that does not speak to—
So that overnight sensation thing
is— It doesn't speak to— I mean, listen, I just turned 49 years old, and, you know, someone in politics had said, oh, and you're still a kid. And I said, only in politics could somebody be 49 years old, and you say that I'm still a kid. But again, you know, this is about, you know, sweat equity and messaging and vision. And I don't just mean about me. I mean, for every woman that has blazed a trail or inherited one, we are not there out of some charity or because of identity politics. But I'm not going to sit here and act like identity doesn't matter, because we're very selective that we only do this to women and women of color. When John F. Kennedy was elected president of the United States as the first Irish Catholic president, the Globe celebrated, because representation matters.
People were like, you gotta stand up and prove yourself. And even Joe Biden, you're hitting my Catholic bone a little bit.
But what I'm trying to say, Tiziana, is that identity matters. We can't pretend it doesn't. It's just, which identity are you going to lead with?
Yeah.
If you were a former iron worker, and now you fight for workers' rights and you're an elected official, that is something to be celebrated, right?
Yeah.
If you overcame addiction or substance use disorder and now you're an elected official and you fight for the recovery community, that is something to be celebrated. BIPOC, you know, people of color don't have the monopoly on identity. Women don't have the monopoly on identity. We all have identities. It's just, what are you leading with?
What are you leading with, and what are other people centering and how
what
they
are,
interact
exactly.
and respond to you?
But we're not going to act like identity doesn't matter, because we're going to bring our conflated lived professional experiences to whatever table we sit at. And it is important. When I was on the Boston City Council, the first budget cycle, every agency that came before me, I said, what about the girls? Their answers were monosyllabic. The second budget cycle, they came with cross-tab multicolored binders. Why? Because they knew someone would call the question. And that is the power of representation. It's not for contrived moments of kumbaya. It's not for more attractive photos. It's not so we can pat ourselves on the back about how progressive we are. It's because of how it shows up. It's the stories that are amplified and suddenly given voice. It's that different questions are asked. Different issues are raised.
Part two now of our conversation with Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. She joined us in WBUR's Studio 3 on Tuesday for a conversation focused not on policy issues, but on who she is as a history-making public official. We left off with politics and we're picking up with pets. Last year, Pressley did a video interview with a then 8-year-old aspiring journalist named Owen, who has alopecia. His mom set up the interview, and during the conversation, Owen's cat entered the picture. And Pressley's reaction was immediate and enthusiastic.
I love animals, all animals. And we do have a cat. And everyone in our household does the work of liberation. So she is named for Sojourner Truth, the great abolitionist,
Sojo, right?
But we call her Sojo. But I love dogs. My life doesn't allow me to have one. But I love animals. And when I was growing up, has been true my whole life. I loved books. I loved animals.
Did you have a pet?
I loved cake.
Up?
Not much has changed.
Wait, favorite flavor of cake?
Lemon pound cake.
Oh, really? But there's no frosting
that
on that.
That is my jam.
Or do you get it with
I'm
glaze?
I'm not an icing person.
What?
No. It's about the consistency of the cake. I wish right now I could shout out some of my favorite local bakers, but I'm too atrophied to do that.
That's all right. I won't
but,
put you on the
but
spot.
Yes, Owen and alopecia. So speaking of taking up space, okay, so let me say this. I have gone through a real style and sort of aesthetic evolution, and not just because you age and bodies change and things like that, but because when I was first elected, I wanted to show that I understood the nonverbal cues and rules that demonstrated you get, culture. And so I aged myself. I felt that people would see me as less legitimate if they knew how old I was. And I was already conspicuous as, a first. And so I was very, central casted mm-hmm. sort of politician.
You did
big
look like sort of a typecast
blazers,
senator.
Lots of pearls, ascots. Let me tell you something. I don't know if your listeners even know what ascots are, but I was 24 years old wearing ascots. And if you
Google that cravat neck thing,
that it was not it.
The kind with the blue border and the gold chain.
It was not it, okay? So I was aging myself. And I'll never forget the moment at the general election night in 2019 after I'd been elected to Congress. And I just ad-libbed off my speech and I said, can a congresswoman wear braids, rock a black leather jacket and a bold red lip? And the room went wild. And I said that because I had finally understood that I could be in alignment. I could show up fully, authentically, unapologetically as myself, as refined, as, wannabe hipster, and still have community, still have support, still walk the corridors of power and sit at policy and decision-making tables, that I can wear hoops and rock a bald head, and I'm no less congressional, no less effeminate, no less pretty, no less worthy of belonging. And so I can't pretend that this alopecia journey has been an easy one. There are days when I want to be in a fetal, and it is hard because so much of what I do in this work, I can never call it a job. So much of what I do in this work requires me to be aesthetically scrutinized, digested, and people are always that much harder on women. And I found such ethnic pride in my hair and felt it such an extension of my femininity and womanhood.
When you went to the Senegalese twists, that was a huge
That was a statement in and of itself to wear a protective hairstyle, grow my relaxer out. And it was the first time that I felt in complete alignment with myself, truly. And so to have gone through all that progress in my self-worth, my ethnic pride, and to have been so callously robbed of these things and so abruptly. A lot of people don't understand.
Alopecia.
I was not living with alopecia for a long time. In a 5-week span, I lost all the hair on my head, my face, and my body, and was going through that publicly. There are several forms of alopecia, and I have alopecia totalis. And it's an autoimmune disease where your immune system attacks your hair follicles. So many people think I shave my head. I do not. The hair just fell out clean, just like that. In fact, I went completely bald the eve of the first impeachment vote. And because everything I do as a woman, as a black woman, is political, even though I would have just happily walked onto the floor, I mean, happily is an overstatement, but could have, to cast that vote and to make my floor statement without hair, there was fear that people would see it as a political statement.
That you were doing it on purpose.
Somehow. Exactly. Because the day before, they saw me with some semblance of hair, and now here I was completely bald. And so at 5 o'clock in the morning, I went to a salon referred to by a friend under the secrecy and cloak of night, and they custom fit me with a wig that didn't feel at all like me, but it was a beautiful wig. And I wore that to cast my vote in the affirmative to impeach the occupant of the White House at that time and to make my floor statement. And then I went into the bathroom and cried. I felt heavy, and it didn't feel an authentic representation of me. And I decided in that stall, in that moment, that I was not going to wear a wig. Now, you never say never. And I always, when I meet members of the alopecia community, and shout out, you know, to my fellow baldies out there, my alopecians. When people will say, they'll whisper to me, you know, in rooms, every day this happens, at a reception, in the hallway, in a restroom, I'm just like you. And they'll say, but I'm not as brave yet. And I always challenge them, yes, you are brave. You are living with this, and all of us have a different walk. And I'll never say never, but for me right now, given all the armor I feel that I have to put on to negotiate and navigate the world, I don't want to put on one more thing. And moreover, since it is Valentine's Day, the love of my life, my husband, Conan Harris, told me two things. One, you don't need hair to rock a crown. And two, he said that he felt that my alopecia revealed my beauty and that the hair had been in the way all that time.
That is a good husband.
He is a great husband. And so I often, you know, joke with people and say, well, if you had these cheekbones, would you wear a wig? You know, but it's really just fake bravado, because a lot of the times I'm very self-loathing, truthfully. This has been a tough journey, and to go through this publicly. But over time, I've really come to see alopecia as like this superpower, because I've had to summon different expressions of my femininity, my womanhood, my strength. You know, it's made me dig that much deeper. And it's not that I was ever a shallow person. I've always been, actually, my mother would probably say, devastatingly deep, you know. I mean, I remember being like 9 years old at the salon with my head in a book, sitting on telephone books so the stylist could reach my head to press my hair with a hot comb to make it straight. And my brow was furrowed. And adults were doing that thing they do where they talk about you like you're not there.
Like you can't hear.
And they said, what is this child always so worried about? And so I then piped up and I said, the world. And I was about 9. So, you know, I've never been a shallow person. I've always been introspective, complicated, deep. But that being said, alopecia has made me dig that much deeper. And now I take great pride in that representation. I know what it means to this community.
I want to play you. We're almost done. Just, I got to be respectful of your time. You are a U.S. Congresswoman who has come here to do this. But I'm going to play you a little bit of music here. You're going to know it.
Okay.
And I'll tell our audience what it is in just a minute.
This joy I have, the world didn't give it to me.
And I wish people could see you here in the studio enjoying it. This particular version, Shirley Caesar, 1975. You love this song. You have said that you love this song. Catholic masses, we don't get that joyful. So the Catholic version is, not as the world gives peace do I give my peace to you. I like this one. This one's more fun. But I wonder, I want to end on
joy. I like the time of Catholic service.
Yeah. Yes. We do keep a tight 60.
You don't need to bring a survival kit.
That's right. We keep a tight 60 without question.
Yeah.
But I do want to end on joy.
Yeah.
Right. And the real joy of spirituality, the world doesn't give it to you.
That's right.
But the world can give us joy.
Yes.
And I want to know what part of the world is giving you the joy that's sustaining you now.
The movement and the work. I believe so fiercely in the work of justice. And I know the only way we get there is through mobilization, so through movement and through legislation, which I say, and this is Valentine's Day, policy is my love language. So, you know, truthfully, although there is, the struggle is real, so too is the joy in the struggle, you know, and in the victories along the way. You know, I would say that outside of obviously my family, you know, our 14-year-old daughter, Cora.
She's 14.
Yes. My husband, Conan, our cat, Zojo, and, you know, my closest friends, my team, you know, having been an aide for 16 years, I know that I'm only as good as them. And in fact, most days they represent me better than I represent myself. So I'm grateful for my aide team, and I find joy in our work together and the victories that we've made possible along the way in advancing the movement and advancing policy that legislates equity, healing, and justice. I did find myself getting a little emotional when you played that song because, again, one of the greatest gifts my mother gave me is my faith in God. And I grew up in the church. And my grandfather, huge influence in my life, was a pastor of a small storefront church on the south side of Chicago for many, many years. And I asked the question, you know, why do you always wish me joy? And it's because happiness is usually based on a happenstance, a very specific moment in time. But joy is something so much deeper, so much more abiding, so much more enduring. And I want everyone to know that kind of joy, the joy that comes from living and feeling safe, the joy that comes from having a peace of mind, the joy that comes from dignity, the joy that comes from a government and a community that sees and centers your humanity every day, the joy that comes from a family, you know, that's healthy and stable and thriving. So I love that we're ending on joy because I would say that is also where it all began.
Shall we hear a little bit more of it on the way out?
Yeah.
All right, let's listen to a little bit more.
Take us to church.
Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents the state's 7th Congressional District. She joined us earlier this week. And we will go out on a little more Shirley Caesar, but there is more ahead. Stay with us. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. The world can give it to me. We're going to continue a conversation now on Black history and identity, specifically the tendency to oversimplify complex historical figures, really in order to make them more palatable. And no better example than the pop culture question, are you a Malcolm or are you a Martin? Here's a tip, you're neither. And Professor Kelly Carter-Jackson says that such oversimplification undermines our ability to understand their place in history, their work, and it allows all of us not to grapple with the challenges that they pose to racism and injustice. Kelly Carter-Jackson is Denise Kellen, 68 Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. She'll be joining us monthly now to talk about all things history and culture as part of a new series called Yes And. Kelly, welcome back to the show.
Hi, happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. And you sat with me here and listened to that conversation we had a couple of days ago with Congresswoman Pressley. So I just want to give you a chance first to have thoughts and reactions on that.
Oh, man, that was so good to hear. It was so good to listen to. I loved her just talking about her mother and the relationship that they had and how, you know, her life and even her transition was energy for her. It was just so powerful. Every time I hear Ayanna Pressley, I fangirl because I think she represents so much of what I also believe in terms of how I see the world and where my values are. And it was just really powerful to hear her talk about her experiences, talk about what brings her joy. Love listening to Shirley Caesar. Yes, it was good. All of it was just really, really good. It made me think of made me think of my own family. And shout out to my daughter, Josephine. It's her birthday today.
How old is she today?
She's six. She's six.
Happy birthday, Josephine.
I don't know. I think about that. I think about how my sister, who passed away from breast cancer, they had the same birthday. And so when I think of my daughter, I think of my sister. And there's so much about how life and death is just intertwined. And I don't know. Congresswoman Presley just reminded me of that. So, yeah, she brought me a lot of joy.
I'm glad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of the reason to kind of start there is in the public sphere, mm-hmm. the congresswoman is often reduced.
Yes.
You know, yes. the squad or mm-hmm. the radical mm-hmm. or, you know, that stereotype, the angry black woman.
Yes, yes. And, or the first.
And, or you the know, first. Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. And part of what you're bringing us in this conversation about two other historical black figures mm-hmm. is this idea that they're whole people. With yes. whole complex. So let's yes. pick up there. Now, I'm mm-hmm. I want to come to your class for a minute.
Yes.
because you start to illustrate that, help people understand mm-hmm. that in your class by doing this pick five exercise.
Oh, I love that. The name five game. Yes.
Okay, so
I played
tell
that.
Us.
So on the first day of every class, we play the first day and really the last day of class, but the first day is what's really important. And I tell students to take out a sheet of paper and, you know, scratch a piece of paper, a pen, pencil, and I give them 30 seconds. Now, normally I give people a minute, but we're at Wellesley, so I give them 30 seconds. And I say, name five notable people. They could be living, could be dead. And I give them different categories. So at first I'll say, name five African-Americans, 30 seconds, go. Most people have no trouble doing that. Someone past or alive, very easy. And then I say, name five Africans. And then I give them 30 seconds, and that's a struggle. And then I say, name five Latinx Americans, name five Native Americans, name five Asian Americans, name five disabled Americans. And we go all down this, you know, roster of making categories and naming five people. And then when the game is over, I say, okay, let's deconstruct your list. If we have, let's say, I don't know, six categories and we have 30 people you could have named. So half of your list is women, right? And even at Wellesley, people are like, kinda. And then I start to deconstruct even more. Well, how many could get five out of five? Or how many could get four out of five? Or three out of five? And then how would you feel if you were, you know, Asian American and no one could name five people that had contributed something to American history, or three people that had contributed something? Or how would you feel if you were Native American and no one could name someone who was alive, who was a contemporary leader? And they start to really sort of get in their feelings about this game. But the point is not to be like, gotcha, you're a racist. That's not the point of the game. The point of the game is to show them how the world has been presented to them, how when we have gut reactions and we're supposed to write and think about who matters, who's important, who's contributed, who's made up America, what is your gut response? Are you hardline to think of men? Are you hardline to think of only sort of, you know, your celebrities, your musical people? But, you know, we don't get a whole lot of architects on the list, or a whole lot of authors on the list, or a whole lot of politicians even. Oftentimes we get actors and actresses, and that makes sense when you're, you know, when you have 30 seconds. But when students say to me, you know, I could have 2 hours and maybe, you know, an encyclopedia and still struggle with these numbers, that tells us a lot about what we're being taught and about what's being erased.
So let's stay in that space. What mm-hmm. we're being taught, what's being erased, and another phrase you used, how the world has been presented to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we move into this space of Team Martin and Team Malcolm. And, you know, our producer, Amanda Beland, did some Googling on this. And one mm-hmm. of the things that was really interesting is there's all these tables and diagrams. One is this, the other is that. And, of course, they're always set up as polar opposites.
Yes, we do this all the time. We do this with Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. We do this with Martin and Malcolm. We are always pitting leaders against each other as though Black people only have two options, as though we can only pick one path forward. And the interesting thing is that with even with Booker T and Du Bois, or with Martin and Malcolm, there's a lot that they have in common. If we're looking at a Venn diagram of their lives, there's a lot of crossover, especially toward the end of their lives for both of them. They saw themselves more in alignment than I think they could have ever imagined. And I think we need to talk about that. I think we need to tease out those.
Why?
Because I think that we are never, and this is all people, we are never just one thing. We are never just team A or team B or pro or con. And I think that flattens the Black experience. It makes it incredibly one-dimensional. Nigerian author Chimamanda Adichie gives this great talk called The Danger of the Single Story. It's a TED Talk. It's 18 minutes. I teach it in every class. And she says, this is what we do. We tell one story over and over and over again. And that is the story. That is the narrative. That's the single speech, whether it's I Have a Dream speech or the ballad or the bullet speech. It's the single shot, the single picture or image of one person either standing at a podium. But we have these very simplistic ideas of who these leaders are. And when you start to pull apart the layers like an onion, you realize, wow, these men are complicated. These men are flawed. These men are really thinking deeply about what liberation should look like and trying to give their people options. And that's really important.
We're speaking with Wellesley Professor Kelly Carter Jackson as we delve into the idea of holding a yes and.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is true, and also this can be true.
Yeah.
And you invited us to talk today about Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. You were just laying some of that out. There, you know, as you're talking, like five thoughts crash into my head. I think the one to go to first is, so why don't we want more complicated Malcolm X and more complicated Martin Luther King Jr.? You know, you talked about them being complicated men, flawed as we all are.
Yeah.
You know, to prepare for today, I watched a documentary called MLK FBI, right? About the FBI trying to publicly shame. And in fact, an FBI official at one point wrote to Martin Luther King Jr. and suggested that he die by suicide.
Yeah, that he kill himself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, clearly a very controversial and seen as un-American man at the time who is now held up as a hero.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't even need the B. I'm just going to turn it back over to you from there.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we've done something quite the opposite with Malcolm X, which is we've turned him into this villain in terms of this, you know, scary, angry, militant Black man who makes Martin much more palatable, I think, to white Americans in particular who are looking at these two men as if these are the options, either violence or nonviolence. Well, then I'm going with the nonviolent option. But I think towards, you know, the end of Martin's life, he saw or at least understood Black rage, Black anger, the need for Black power, the need for a much more militant and aggressive approach to ending things like, you know, racism and structural racism and Jim Crow. He realized that a lot of the civil rights movement had been gotten on the cheap. You know, there were no reparations. There's no restorative justice that's brought to Black people who have either lost their homes through redlining or who have lost meaningful wages or been able to obtain meaningful wages. And he realizes that the war on Vietnam is also, it's much bigger than race, that this is about globalization, this is about capitalism, this is about, you know, a post-colonial world. There's a lot more to this story. And we don't talk about those things with Martin Luther King. We really boil him down to just the speech and the dream and things that make us feel good. And we don't compel people to think critically. And that's what's really important. People are complicated. And while it's digestible to have this very simple narrative, it does not allow us to reckon with history. And when we don't reckon with history, we don't have a roadmap for how to have effective change, lasting change.
So I'm just going to, as an aside to our listeners, we talked about that move by the FBI. So if you or someone you love is experiencing a mental health crisis or having suicidal thoughts, you can call the National Mental Health Hotline at 988. Again, that number is 988. In listening to you right now, Kelly Carter Jackson, what hits me is you say the two of them are very much closer than we might think in their realizations towards the end of their lives. And yet we have set them up as foes, right? As Lex Luthor and Batman, right? where we only know of Malcolm X in popular history as being disruptive and violent and angry. We only know Martin Luther King. So Why did Martin Luther King Jr. get to be the good guy? And why is Malcolm X only allowed to be the bad guy?
Yeah, I think part of it, so there's a lot of different ways you could answer that. I think part of the way that Malcolm X gets maligned is because he was a part of the Nation of Islam, and there were no real attempts to understand Islam, this sort of new religion that was not a part of the official religion of Islam. The Nation of Islam was like a subsect of that, and people didn't understand it, and it seemed radical and militant, and it seemed also very anti-white. And so he becomes this fringe leader in that way. Martin Luther King Jr. is representing, you know, the CLC, the Christian Leadership Conference, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He's a Christian. And so while we have sort of a framework for Christianity, it allows us to applaud him a little bit more, to see him as a person that is pushing nonviolence and pushing civil disobedience. And that feels palatable for a lot of people. But, you know, when Malcolm X leaves the Nation of Islam, and becomes a Muslim, and starts really thinking about how can we be much more inclusive. You know, towards the end of his life, he's not just working with Black people. He's working with all people of all nations. Anyone that wants to do this work of liberation, Malcolm is willing to work with them. And that really puts a target on his back in a lot of ways. And the same, I think it's because, you know, and keep in mind, he was still a target when he was in the Nation of Islam. He was still someone that the FBI was concerned about. He was still something that the FBI was following. But when he starts to do this much more progressive pivot and turn and be more inclusive toward bringing other people into the fold, that's an even bigger threat for the FBI. It's an even bigger threat for people who are concerned with promoting white supremacy. Because the more you get solidarity, the more you get people on board, the more you might actually create real change. And that change threatened people that wanted to hold on to their power and maintain that power. And you see the same thing with Martin Luther King as well.
So to make sure I understand, it was the moment at which his outreach was broader, and therefore he had the potential for broader appeal.
Absolutely. You know, Malcolm X, this is one thing that's not covered in his film. Many people have seen the Spike Lee film, but he traveled all over the world. All over the world. He's at the Bangdung Conference in 1859. He's speaking with Asians. He's speaking with Africans. He's meeting with African leaders. You know, he's talking about a post-colonial world and how all people of color around the world can reckon with this and how people can find peace and find justice for themselves. Oftentimes, people don't know, and oh my gosh, I'm hoping I'm not going to blink on her name, but when Malcolm X is assassinated, there is an Asian woman whose Malcolm's head is cradled in her lap. Oh, gosh, isn't it famous?
We'll see if we can find out for you, but we've only got 30 seconds.
Yes, I know. It's going to come to me. It's going to come to me. But I don't think we realized just the Black and Asian alliance that took place among Malcolm X. That was so powerful. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of erasure and a lot of forgetting when we talk about radical leaders because we don't want to remember their impact.
And that's really... again, we're on our way out of the show, but what I should take away from today is that idea that erasure and forgetting eliminates the complexities, and in the complexities is where we can learn.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Kelly Carter Jackson is the Michael and Denise Kellen 68 Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. We'll be seeing her monthly here on Radio Boston. Always enjoy having you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Rob Lane with Bart Tachi and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director with help today from Patrick O'Connor. Titus Faladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.